Josh Strickens grabbed me. His right arm wrapped tightly around my shoulders, pinning me in place. I struggled, but his left hand raised a knife to my throat. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. Josh's mouth, reeking of alcohol, was pressed to the side of my face.
He left me no choice. Look around. Look at them. Not only am I going to kill you, I am going to kill the people close to you.
Immediately, I knew that it was all over. This is the Disappearance Podcast, Episode 5, The Dragon. Tom Allegost had been missing for 2 days when I started getting the phone calls.
Hello, John. This is Tom.
And remember that they were not calls from any one man, but rather frantic calls from multiple versions of him, angry at me for letting this happen to him. I knew that I needed to draw him away, all of them, to somewhere safe where I could talk straight with them and explain that they were never going home. It was going to be a tough conversation. It was the same conversation that Samuel Johnson had had many times with the many different versions of his friend, Joshua Reynolds. Traveling as they had done was a one-way ticket. There was no going back. They could settle in secret with new names as if they were in a witness protection program, or disappear again for another chance at finding a better place, a better life. I needed to tell him, them, that not all worlds were created equal, and that for some reason, some worlds worked like magnets, lodestones, pulling travelers like themselves to them. I would tell them that my friend, Alistair Glamis, had once explained to me that his greatest wish was to find a world with no other Alistairs, a place where he alone could call home. The remote location where I decided to meet with Tom Allegost, however many versions of him I could find, was Barton, New Hampshire. It was far off. It was quiet. I set a date several days away and put an outgoing message on my phone explaining where I would be. Here's that message.
Hello, you've reached the phone of John Herman. I will be in Barton, New Hampshire on Saturday. The post office. Inconspicuous. Be inconspicuous.
I barely use my personal phone, so the likelihood that some stranger would call and get the message was slim. I explained to Carol that I needed to go to Barton. Of course, I admitted it was something to do with the audio project, something that Tom and I had been working on that I needed to explore before I finally let it all go. I didn't record that particular conversation. By that time, I had stopped recording entirely. Even if I had, I'm not sure I would play it now. Because I had to lie to her. And, well, it was the last conversation I ever had with my wife. The next night, I drove up to Barton. During the long car ride, I replayed the words in my mind that I would say to Tom Allegost, to all of him. My phone had filled up with over 100 messages, but I didn't know how many were from the same man. Were there 5 of him? 10? 20? I knew I needed to comfort him. His life was over, at least the life he once knew. Tom Allegost needed to know that the woman living in his house was not his wife. It was the wife of another Tom Allegost, who himself had disappeared. I would have to explain that she deserved to grieve her loss because her husband was never, ever coming home. I anticipated that they would argue. Perhaps the many Toms would want to compete for a place as the one and only Tom. But I would tell them that that was a dangerous path. I would tell them right then and there that I had seen how this all played out and it wasn't pretty. I would tell Tom about the dragon, and if the need arose, then I would explain that I was a murderer. Tom Allegost was not a murderer. Not yet, at least. Hopefully not ever. I was desperate to shield him from that dark path. Before I settled in for the night at the Crescent House Bed and Breakfast, where I had rented a room, I drove through downtown, or what little downtown Barton can claim. There was the Barton Public Library, the country store, and the post office. I didn't stop. You see, I had driven down one day early so I could prepare. I had brought tools. Of course, I was worried about having two or more Tom Allegosts show up at the post office. If they saw each other, then they might argue or even go mad on the spot. But I needed to take a gamble. The Barton post office has one thing that no other building in the whole town has. A community bulletin board. A place where everyone in town can figure out what's going on. The board sits just outside the main entrance. That night, in my room at the Crescent House, I made a sign. On top of it, I put the symbol of a pineapple. It was a symbol that I knew he knew was associated with our investigation. It is a symbol for welcome. Below it, I wrote the following. Midnight at Bascom's Bridge. Between the sign and my mentioning the word inconspicuous in the voicemail message, I hoped that Tom would lay low, hide his face, and trust that I would explain everything. I then spent the rest of the night with my tools, working on my project. I sat in my car for much of the next day, just watching the entrance to the post office. I felt bad for leading Tom on what was a wild goose chase, but I needed to make sure that I got to the mall. The first Tom arrived around 9 in the morning. He had a baseball cap pushed low over dark sunglasses. I could still tell it was him. He walked up to the post office, and just as I guessed he would, he stopped at the community bulletin board. He saw the pineapple. He read my cryptic note and looked around. The second Tom surprised me by walking right past my car. A third Tom did the same, and they just missed each other by seconds. Tom after Tom visited the post office. Some of the strangest mysteries are hidden in plain sight, I guess.
Paint a picture of what you see when you look at me. What will those abstract shapes turn?
That night, as I walked to Bascom's Bridge, I knew that I needed to stay calm. I would be confronting my friend at the most terrifying moment of his life. But I was still his friend. He was Reynolds. I was about to be Johnson. As I stepped onto the bridge, I stepped among a crowd of men. There were 40 or 50 of them. They were all silent and still. Their faces were hidden by hooded sweatshirts and hats pulled down over their eyes. Tom Allegost was scared to show his face. Perhaps he knew who it was standing around him. He was standing around himself. The moon above us made rays stream sparkle. I pulled myself up onto the railing of the bridge so I could stand over the men I would be addressing. I spoke quietly, in an attempt to keep things somber and safe.
I'm so sorry, Tom. You're right. I knew this could happen. I knew this was a possible danger. Something beyond my control.
I've heard about it before. I've seen it before. Alistair Glamis called it the dragon. The name refers to the chaos that always follows when they learn too much. I learned from Alistair's father that while we desperately try to put it in order, the universe is pure and utter chaos, ruthless and unkind to our feelings. But I have a gift for you. I have a gift for all of you. It's a key.
It was a master key. An exact copy of the key that Alistair and I had hid in the cardboard box along with the vinyl records. All night, I had sat in my room in the Crescent House, making copies of that key.
It is a key that can open any mailbox in the Barton Post Office. But that's not what you're going to do with it. When you turn the key, you're going to go to a different world. This is a system that Alistair developed to give himself some kind of order. You see, all the mailboxes are numbered, all in order. An order you can't find in nature. An unnatural system that can enable you to control your direction. If you wish to go back to a world you visited, then you only need to go back to that number and turn the key.
But what I had not yet explained, couldn't yet put into words, was that Tom would not be able to get back to his own original world. Not ever.
You are going to spread out, exploring new worlds. I encourage you to find a place where you can live in peace. Your home is out there, but there is an infinite amount of doors to open. You won't find it. No one ever has. You can't beat infinity. I know this is confusing. I know this isn't perfect. I know you just want to make sense of it. You just want me to send you home. But that is not going to happen, Tom. And it's all my fault. So please, take the key.
As I put my hands in my pockets to reveal the keys, a man stepped from the shadows and violently pulled me from the railing. It was not Tom. This man was taller. He had broad shoulders, and even as he approached, I could tell that he smelled of alcohol. As he spoke, I knew, almost immediately, that no special system was going to solve this mess. No hidden recording, no commonplace book, no key. When I looked into the wild face of Josh Strickens, I knew that the dragon had come.
Who entereth herein, a conqueror hath been. Who slayeth the dragon, the shield he shall win.
That is the voice of Alistair Glamis, reciting a quote that he and I left on the cardboard box whose contents were kept if ever I found myself blindsided with the chaos. I could use the contents of the box to do battle, to create a shield, or simply to run.
I am the only one who can do it. I am the only one that can save the world. I've listened to everything you've said, and it's madness. This is crazy, and I am the only one who can stop it. I don't know if you're Johnson or Reynolds. I don't understand who you people are or what you plan to do here, but I am not gonna let this happen.
Josh Strickens was a complete stranger to me. Of course, later I would learn of different versions of him, interacting with different versions of me. I would learn how he grew up in Barton, graduated a few years earlier than I did. I would learn that he had found Alistair's commonplace book and a bunch of copies of The Incredible Being in the Glamis cabin the night before it burned to the ground. Josh would read the books, which would trigger a fear in him that mixed with his alcoholism and the observation that multiple versions of the same men were walking around his small town, would all come together to produce the paranoid, fearful man who now pointed a large knife at me.
I don't need you to explain a thing. I read the book. I read his journal. The kid who went missing. Don't play dumb. I know what you guys are. You're monsters!
At this moment, several of the Toms stepped forward. Good old Tom Alagos tried to save me, even though I had ruined his life.
No.
One of them grabbed Josh by the arm and tried to twist the knife from his grasp. The two struggled in the darkness, while the others stepped back. There was a cry of pain, and the shadow of Tom Alagos fell to the ground. Then, Josh Strickens turned and lunged at me. I tried to throw myself over the railing. I thought maybe I could jump into the stream. But Josh grabbed me from behind, placed the knife to my throat, and said the words that opened this episode. There was a flood of emotions and thoughts as I, pinned, watched Tom Alagos die in front of me. My friend, blood spilled all over the bridge. It looked black in the moonlight. And then he was still. I had never traveled before, but I knew everything I needed to. I read and understood Eureka by Edgar Allan Poe. I studied The Garden of Earthly Delights by Hieronymus Bosch. I had memorized the poems of William Blake. I knew the coded passages of William Shakespeare. I didn't want to go, but I knew I needed to in order to protect my wife, Carol, from the chaos, from the dragon in the form of Josh Strickens. I needed to disappear, and more importantly, I needed to take Josh Strickens with me. It was the only way to be sure that everyone would be safe. So with his face pressed to mine, and his blade against my throat, I pushed back. I struggled so that his own grip and force intensified. He struggled to keep the knife pointed at me. It was a struggle of wills that only intensified further as we both saw what happened around us. You see, one by one, the many versions of Tom Alagos began to disappear. To Josh Strickens, it confirmed that horror had engulfed his small town. I'm not sure why Tom left. Maybe it was unintentional. Maybe he just needed to run. But I cried out to stop him, because I knew if he left now, then he would be lost. Without the key, he would have nothing to guide him. My pockets were still filled with his salvation. I was weighted down with the reminder of how much things had spun out of control. Without a system, without a guide, each man, each and every Tom Alagos, started his own path out into the unknown. As he disappeared around us, the fading crowd revealed the sparkling stream still lit by the moon. As the terror no doubt filled his very being, Josh Strickens, who still held me from behind, began to thrust the knife towards himself, into me. As the force of his will became too much for me to shield, I took a deep breath. I closed my eyes, and I too disappeared. The next sensation I felt was water. I was underwater, weighted down by the keys in my pockets. I sank lower and lower as I released the keys into the water, allowing them to sink to the stream bed. And then I let the current take me. While I didn't see it, I imagine that the knife went through me as I disappeared and pierced Josh Strickens in the chest. This is a fiction I've created for myself to help me sleep at night. I also imagine the next morning several kids looking to go fishing found two dead men on the bridge. Tom Alagos would be found, giving his worried wife some tragic closure. Josh Strickens would be found, and accused of murder. My wife would surely hear the news and try to get in contact with me. When it was certain that I was now missing, perhaps the police would determine that I was at this tragic meeting, and they would dive into Ray's stream to retrieve my body. Except that they would never, ever find me, because I was in another world. During my next episode, I will finish my confession. You will learn of the murder I committed as a teenager. You will learn of my current fate, as well as the ultimate fate of Alistair Glamis. In the meantime, thank you to John and Danielle Herman for making this episode possible. Thanks also to Ben von Wildenhaus, Rudy Sims, Ben Aldrich, and Prom Queen for providing the music. This show is a co-production with Partners in Crime Media. Let's talk soon.
Partners in Crime Media.